And I'm going to introduce our next and final two speakers, Annika Munsell and Evan Christensen, who I have had the pleasure of working very closely with over the past years. And they are here to share some of the details of a process that they're in the middle of. So this is not a complete and final project, but it's really a process that we wanted to share. And I was interested in having them share this because I think it is a nice illustration of one way, certainly not the only way, to look at all of the information that we've been hearing today. And so they're using an optimization modeling approach. And this is a way that they're considering the existing infrastructure information we heard about, the investments that have been made in infrastructure, bringing in the recharge component through the regional groundwater flow model, including water demand, but also incorporating some of those resource protection thresholds that we just heard from Steve about. And so how do you put all that together? This is a big picture process. This is not what's going to happen right here underneath us, but in a big picture, can we have an approach to be thinking about this? And I do think this is how I'm going to end on the cloud computing. The modeling and the data crunching that they've been doing might actually be, if the lights flicker in the next couple of months at your house, this might be part of the reason why. Thank you.
So we started off today with Dr. Strock talking about simple modeling, kind of site-specific type things. Evan and I are going to be talking about a very complex regional model using Metro Model 3 for optimization. One of the questions I've heard a lot since I started working for the Met Council from different communities is, how much water do we have? And this isn't a new question. People have been asking this for to me it seems like a long time, at least since 1973. In 1973, the USGS estimated 1,300 million gallons per day. And then in 1990, it was changed to an estimate was 500 to 800 million gallons per day. So what changed between 1973 and 1990? Was it the hydraulic properties of the aquifers? No, it's the way that we understand sustainability. For the optimization, I'll give you the results right away. For the 7-county metro area, our optimization pumping rate was between 400 and 500 million gallons per day. This is at the low end of past estimated ranges, and this shows how the sustainability changes over time. So as sustainability changes, the amount of groundwater that can be pumped sustainably changes. So our process thus far has been reviewing the statutes, getting some stakeholder input, talking with the DNR and communities, running the model, reviewing it, and repeating. So right now we're in the review part, so if you have comments, please let me know. We'd really appreciate it. So statutes say really helpful things like sustainable groundwater use does not harm ecosystems, degrade water quality, or compromise the ability of future generations to meet their needs. How do we put that into something measurable? Steve started touching on it today. And then how do we put that into model speak? So we have three different categories. One is surface water, groundwater connections. One is human health, and one is aquifer safe yield. And I will start with the surface water, groundwater connections. I'm going to be using flux. That term just means the water flowing in and out of the groundwater system. So for FENS, it said no degradation at all. Well, we put that in the model, and our model will blow up, stop working, grind to a halt. So we allowed 1 foot of change, pretty minimal. For trout streams and groundwater-supported lakes that were shallow with a really wide littoral zone, no more than 10% change in flux between surface water and groundwater. This is fairly consistent with trout streams. For the Mississippi River, we realized that it's not nearly as vulnerable as a lot of these smaller systems, so we allowed up to a 25% change in flux. And then for all other surface water bodies, no more than a 15% change in flux between the surface water and groundwater, just like Steve talked about. So the next is human health. So we have pretty good groundwater quality in most areas, but there are some areas where the groundwater has been degraded. And we don't want to move those known plumes all over the place and contaminate more groundwater. So we allowed the plume flow direction to change by no more than 10% in any direction. This would hopefully make sure that the existing containment system would continue to work. And then the third thing is the aquifer safe yield, same figure that Steve had. For all confined aquifers except for the Mount Simon, we went down to that 50% head threshold, and in order to do a percent decline, you need a starting place. We chose 2010. It seemed like a good year to start. We have a lot of really good data from that year. It was a census year. Most of the data has been vetted, so it's a good starting place. For the Mount Simon, it's a protected aquifer in the Twin Cities area, and so we allowed no more than 1 foot of drawdown there as well. And then for all the unconfined aquifer levels, we assume that the surface water constraints will actually confine those. And then now to Evan to talk about what is optimization and how we put it all together.
Okay, so when we talk about pumping optimization, what do we really mean? I guess what it really means is we're trying to maximize the amount we can pump without exceeding those thresholds that Annika and Steve have just gone through. So I'll use things like threshold and sustainability constraint, and those things sort of mean the same thing. So we don't want to decrease base flow by more than 15%, or we don't want to draw down heads and confined aquifers below our safe yield. Those are things that are sustainability constraints or thresholds. So why do we need to do this as an optimization model? Why do we need to use these sort of sophisticated methods? One is that it's a planning tool. So it allows us to look forward and identify areas of concern and areas of little concern so that we can use that information to guide future studies or to guide future planning. Modeling helps us wrap our hands around complex geospatial relationships. So not only where wells are located and how they interact in a horizontal sense, but also in a vertical sense. So wells that may be pumping from a deeper bedrock aquifer, are the impacts associated with some of the larger river systems, or in a local flow system with some of the smaller streams? And also looking, getting our hands around the time lag issues. So if you're reliant on a monitoring network only, typically that's more of a reactive strategy, where once you realize that you're in trouble, it's kind of too late, versus modeling helps you look forward and react proactively. So just a little example on the time lag issue and getting ahead of the game. This is just a simple generic simulation that uses a locally refined area within the Metro Model 3 and just putting it in a well in the Jordan Aquifer and pumping it at a steady rate of 1,000 gallons a minute. And looking at drawdown in the Jordan and the water table and a change in flux in a nearby stream. So this would be drawdown on the y-axis and time in years on the x-axis. So, and that dashed line there is when you reach steady state. So once you're pumping that well at a continuous rate of 1,000 gallons a minute, how long it takes to get to that steady state. And this simulation only went out 10 years, and you're still not quite to that steady state equilibrium condition. And if we move up to the water table, the time lag is much longer than in the source aquifer itself. Again, going out 10 years, you're still not to that steady state condition. So if you're relying on something like monitoring only, you're 10 years plus and you're still not to that ultimate impact. Same thing with change in flux, or this would be the change in base flow. So negative value means a reduction in base flow. Again, same concept, not quite reaching steady state. So how we do this in a little more detail, we use code developed by the USGS called groundwater management process. That's an optimization code that's designed to link into ModFlow, which is the code that Metro Model 3 is. We had to do some slight modifications to have them link directly. And what we do is we allow pumping within the 7-county metro area of all existing wells to vary, except for wells in the Mount Simon and some special use categories where that pumping remains fixed at the baseline condition. And they're all steady state simulations. So like those previous slides, we're projecting out to that ultimate impact. So just a brief overview of what Metro Model 3 is. To describe Metro Model 3 in detail would be a couple hour talk. So I tried to boil it down into one slide. So it was completed in the spring of 2014, and it covers the 11-county metropolitan area. The image there on the left is the model boundary. And then it has 9 layers, and those layers are designed to represent all the major aquifers and aquitards in the metro area. And that's all I'll say about Metro 3. So wells. Like I mentioned, we are pumping, or we're allowing wells, existing wells in the 7-county metro area to vary their rates and pump them as hard as possible without exceeding our sustainability thresholds. And this is just a distribution of what those wells are and the use classes that those wells represent. So it's 2,074 wells that we're allowing the pumping to vary to get that maximum volume we can without exceeding our thresholds. And just an overview of the constraints that we've discussed to lay out sort of how this falls out in the number of constraints that are involved. And we can break them down into 3 categories. One is ahead, so that's related to drawdown in the Mount Simon Hinckley, the safe yield in all the other confined bedrock aquifers, and drawdown at calcareous fens. Flux constraints, that's our constraints on the base flow to streams, and that's our constraint on fluxes from lakes. And I'll talk a little bit why they're broken into these different categories in a moment. And then the change in flow direction. So that's the 10-degree change in flow direction along regional contamination plumes. So in total, 5,237 constraints. So the fen constraints, there's just those dots there are the calcareous fens in the metro area, 6 of them. Constraints on safe yield. Basically, how that's distributed is at the location of all of those wells that we're allowed to pump, there's head constraints imposed with the assumption that if you're going to exceed that drawdown constraint or that safe yield constraint, you'll exceed that constraint at the location of the pumping well itself first. Trout streams, we allowed the flux to deviate by up to 10%, and those are the distribution of trout streams in the metro area, and the kind of blocky nature to that is that this is the actual model cell size. And then the rest of the river fluxes, so that's the rest of the rivers simulated in the model. There's a slight distinction between the Mississippi River, with the recognition in early iterations is recognized that we really should back off on the amount of flux that we can allow to change from the Mississippi River. So that is a 25% change versus all the other ones at 15. Sites of high biodiversity, so areas that have high biodiversity and sort of are groundwater dependent, allowing those to change by 15%. Lakes that have a wide littoral zone and they're groundwater dependent have a smaller flux constraint of 10% change, and that's areas similar to Wiper Lake, where a small drop in lake stage can have a much more dramatic effect because it has this wide, shallow littoral zone. And then the rest of the lakes. So the rest of the lakes are simulated in these chunks. So they're broken down into groups by township scale. So each different shade of brown there is a different township, and that's how we group the rest of the lake. So as a total flux from all the lakes within that township can't change by more than 15%. And then just showing that all sort of on one image looks like this. So as Steve mentioned, they have this threshold that they're starting to develop that's half acre foot in water basins, and that's equivalent to about 6 inches per year. And so there's kind of a question, well, why don't we use that as our threshold rather than a 15%? And the reason is the way lakes are simulated within the model. They use the river package of ModFlow, which basically means that they're simulated with a fixed stage. So the stage is fixed for the individual lake, and the amount of water that can flow into or out of that river cell is dependent on the stage that you set, the head and the aquifer, and a conductance, which is essentially a function of the hydraulic conductivity of the bed material. So what we at this large regional scale, we're not able to simulate an actual change in stage, which would be, you know, 6 inches would be that threshold that Steve had mentioned. So we use a 15% change in flux, which is similar to the base flow constraint. It's not that we couldn't do this, but it's very difficult at such a large regional scale. And then finally, the flow direction. So the flow directions are defined by essentially setting up a three-point problem around all the regional plumes and calculating the flow direction from the simulated head at those points and doing a three-point problem. So how does it work? Essentially, this is just a simple schematic of what goes on behind the scenes. For every well that we allow to change, you have to run the model at least one time. And basically what you're doing when you're running that model one time for every well is you're developing a sensitivity to each pumping rate. And so we have to run it thousands of times because we have over 2,000 wells that are being adjusted. Then we have to solve what's called a linear problem, a linear program, and then we sort of repeat that. So we iterate through. We do that over and over again. And at each iteration, we're getting a little bit more total pumping out of the entire system. Like Lanya had mentioned, you know, cloud computing, that's where this comes in. So that middle area with the yellow squares, where we have to run it thousands of times depending on the number of wells, we can distribute that across physical machines, virtual machines, or the cloud. So we can actually run that relatively quickly because we can run hundreds or thousands of model simulations in parallel at once. It's the part on the right that takes the most time. So the time it takes to solve that part on the right is related to the number of constraints we have to the third power. So we have over 5,000 constraints, and we are trying to be very careful to not have too many when we develop those 5,000. So it's that part on the right that really limits how much time it takes to run these optimizations. And for each iteration, that part on the right takes over a day. So you maybe run through 15 to 20 iterations per optimization, so you're looking at 15 to 20 days of continuous runtime to complete. So how's it look? The slide there, or the bar on the left, is the baseline pumping rate. So it's broken down into two colors there. The upper brown are pumping wells that we didn't allow the pumping to change from those. So that's a fixed pumping rate. So that brown bar on top is the same size in both the left and right. The green are wells pumping from wells that we allowed to change. And so the total from baseline to optimize goes from 316 to 429. Million gallons per day, or 36% increase. And that's 429 is the volume pumped before we exceed any thresholds. And we can break it down. We have pumping rates from all the wells within the model, and we can break that down and look at it at subregions to help guide future planning and get a hint at areas that may be already approaching their thresholds and areas that, you know, planned pumping really isn't approaching thresholds. And this is just a distribution of how that might break down. The other thing that's interesting that you can get out of this sort of work is understanding which constraints are really driving your total pumping. And so each constraint has what's called a shadow price. And the shadow price is essentially how sensitive the optimization is to that individual constraint. So constraints with a larger shadow price are more sensitive, and it's basically saying that if you were to remove that constraint from the optimization completely, or if you were to back off on on your tolerance of that, so say, you know, you're saying can't have more than 15% reduction in base, well, if you back off to 50%, it's those constraints that have the higher shadow price that are holding it back the most. And so this is just a distribution of those constraints. And we say that they're binding when the shadow price is greater than zero, essentially. So of the total 5,000 plus constraints, I wrote this down here, one second, only 184 of them are binding. So what that means is that if it's not binding, that constraint really isn't holding back the total amount we can pump. It's the binding constraints that are holding us back. If we look at the top 10 binding constraints shown here, the individual color or the length of the bar is the total shadow price. Or basically, it's saying that if you were to get rid of the Mississippi River through downtown St. Paul as a constraint, saying we can reduce base flow through that reach as much as we want, we'd get the most bang for our buck as far as additional pumping from the region. The colors indicate the group of constraints. So the sort of salmon color are fluxes to rivers. The greenish color is lakes on that township scale, and the blue color there is a biodiversity area. So one thing that I'll zoom in here. One thing that shows up a lot is that the Mississippi River in particular, so the Mississippi River makes up the number 1, 2, 5, and 7 most binding constraints, basically meaning that if we back off on allowing more reduction in base flow for the Mississippi River, we get a larger increase in total pumping for the entire region. And I'll explain why that is in a minute. So if we look things by group here, we can see the sum of the total binding constraints. So the two things that are have the largest total sum are townships and lakes, so basically flux from lakes, and flux change in base flow to the streams. What's interesting is things like drawdown and change in head at fens really have, you know, the shadow price and is very small, basically meaning that drawdown and fen head at fens aren't really limiting how much we can pump as a region. It's the flux to our streams and the flux from our lakes. And this is just looking at it. This is the sum total, and this is looking at an average shadow price. So why are the flux constraints so much more binding? Why are they holding us back the most? If this is a little schematic where that blue line in the middle is a river, and each of those little circles is a well, and so what we were trying to do is pump as much from all those circles as possible. So if we look at drawdown constraints or our safe yield constraints, an individual safe yield constraint might only be limiting the pumping from those red circles. So up there in that upper left, if there's a drawdown constraint in the center of that circle, that constraint's really only limiting the pumping from those wells in the red. Versus if we look at the wells that are, if we look at a base flow constraint or flux constraint on the stream, the geographic extent that constraint is influencing is much larger. So it's basically holding back the pumping from a much larger number of wells, and therefore holding back the total much more. So sources of uncertainty, there's a lot. This is a very non-unique solution, basically meaning that you can come up with a lot of different combinations of pumping rates. So you could pump well A at 100 and well B at 0, or you could pump well A and B at both at 50 and come to the same total pumping volume, but a different pumping distribution. Like I mentioned, the lake levels are not simulated directly, so that can lead to some uncertainty in how we're able to set up the constraints. Changing them can have a big effect. So if we eliminate constraints, we can dramatically, in some cases, increase the total pumping for the region. Or if we apply more constraints, we're going to have less pumping for the region. There's the parameter uncertainty part. So parameters such as hydraulic conductivity of the individual aquifers and how that affects drawdown is a source of uncertainty. And a little nuance in how we set this up, and that we're only pumping existing wells. So putting in additional wells in undeveloped areas would result in additional total pumping. And then operational constraints. We allowed pumping to go down to zero or go up to essentially, I think it was 1,500 gallons a minute. And you know, is that physically possible? In some situations, from an individual well, it might not be. And in other situations, going down to zero on a well might not be acceptable. And that's not included in this. So how's it look if we graph it out? So Annika had essentially the two bars on the left, and then the bar on the right there is our current sustainable limit as set up in this simulation. And so the change there from from left to right isn't that we have less water or that we can pump less. It's that how we define sustainable pumping has essentially changed. The bar there on the left is if we that's more how much water we physically could pump. If we didn't care about affecting base flow and streams, or we didn't care about drawing down our lakes, we could physically pump close to that much on the left. But as we try to create a balance between human use and ecological use, we end up somewhere closer to the right. I think that's all I got. Thank you.